This is a continuation of the oral history interview on July 6, 2006 with Professor Emerita Hazel Carter.
Yes, it was round about this time that I started to get interested in the way African languages had travelled and influenced the development of language on this side of the Atlantic. And this came about very largely because I was, as I told you perhaps, was studying Congo, and especially Angolan Congo, which is near the eastern, the western seaboard. And it was from that area that a number of the slaves had come. Incidentally...
Oh, is that right?
Yes. When African Americans started looking for their roots and trying to learn African languages because of that, most of them chose Swahili, which is the most irrelevant language because it was from the eastern seaboard and there were very few slaves that came from there. Most of them came from the west, especially from places like Ghana, Nigeria, and the western seaboard of the bulge, if you like. And some of them came from Angola too. Now, one of the things that happened here was that I found the works of Lorenzo Dow Turner. Now, have you heard of him?
No.
He was an African American, born, according to some of his biographies, in 1890, which is when my dad was born, or in others, 1895. And he wrote a book called Africanisms in the Gullah Dialect. Now, are you aware of Gullah?
I am. Mm-hmm.
The language of the Sea Island.
Off Georgia.
Yes. He had studied this. He had got a degree from Chicago, I think it was, because his father was an amazing man. He got a degree from Chicago, although he only started school when he was 21. And I think, Lorenzo Dow Turner had his difficulties too, but he did get his degree and so on and went on to a very distinguished career. He had been to the Sea Islands, had heard Gullah, and had studied it. Now, his idea was that because a great many of the slaves did come from West Africa, there would be influences from languages like Yoruba. And he studied in particular the names they gave people, and said that you could trace a lot of these names back to Yoruba. You could also trace a number of the, not simply the vocabulary, but the features of Gullah to African languages. Well, I looked at this work, and especially the names, and thought, well, a lot of these could have come from Congo. And there are a number of words, not simply in Gullah, but also in general American. Have you heard of Guba peas, have you?
Yes.
Do you know where Guba comes from?
No.
Well, the Congo word for peanut or ground nuts, you say peanut here?
Peanuts.
Is Nguba.
Really?
Yes.
Sure, I know the song about eating goober peas.
That's right. The word zombie. There are arguments about that. There are several possible etymologies for that. But they're all African. And a couple of them at least are from Congo. So I wrote a little article about this.
Really?
And then I discovered that there were conferences going on about the influence of African languages, especially on the Caribbean Creoles. So I took the bit between my teeth and started going to conferences. I hadn't been allowed to go to conferences, but at this time, you see, I had got my PhD, I had got my, I think I had got the readership, so I had, as it were, revolted. can be very revolting. So I insisted on doing this sort of thing. And it proved very rewarding indeed. I found a great many interesting things, as you can imagine, and made many, many new friends, uh-huh. especially in the Caribbean universities.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, there were also a number of people from America.
Uh-huh. Conclude side two of tape three. This is tape number four, side one of the ongoing oral history interview with Professor Emerita Hazel Carter of the Department of African Languages and Literature, July 6th, 2006. So we were beginning to
We were discuss, somewhere in the West Indies, I think.
Yes.
Probably in Barbados.
Uh-huh.
Or maybe St. Thomas. Anyway, during those visits, of course, I met a number of people, including Professor Frederick Cassidy, who had been working on Jamaican Creole. I think it was probably he who told me about the Kumina people, who became quite important later in my life. And eventually, he was instrumental in arranging a lecture tour for me to Michigan State University and the University of Wisconsin.
And that would have been in 1980?
I think it would have been a year or two beforehand, because I see that 1980 was the year that I actually came here as visiting professor.
Mm-hmm.
And it was before that, of course, that I did this little lecture tour. And met again Patrick Bennett, who had been a colleague of mine in SOAS. In fact, we had shared an office for 3 years. I think he had been to MSU and then come on to the university here. Now, I had given my lecture here somewhere near the top of Van Hise Hall, looking out over Lake Mendota, and I must say I was taken with the view.
You're in good company.
And taken with the people there too. Patrick and I had lunch together, and I was saying what a nice place this was and I wouldn't mind being here, and Patrick said, oh, and I would love to get back to London. So that was the beginning of it, and we cooked up an exchange between us, where he would come to SOAS and I would come here. And that is in fact what happened. I became a visiting professor here for the years 1980-81, and Patrick went back to SOAS. He took over my students, and vice versa. Now, after that 1 year, I had to go back to...
There was an issue connected, was there not, with your coming as a visiting professor?
Yes, there was a price to pay. Now, I had been for some years connected with the University of, we will call it its modern name, the University of Harare. First of all, I was the university examiner when it was the University College of the Federation, as it then was. Then I became the external examiner in Shona. And in order to do that, I and another colleague, David Rycroft, who was concerned with the other major languages of Zimbabwe, that is Ndebele, we used to go out together for the examinations in November every year, for about 10 days, sometimes as much as 3 weeks. It was usually when the rain started. In fact, so regularly did the rain start on the day we arrived that I was given the name Munaisi, which means one who causes the rain, the rainmaker, if you like.
A anyway. Famous American play.
The Rainmaker? Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Anyway, so I, when all the arrangements had been made for the trip here, I thought, well, I had better tell them that I needed these 10 days off to go to do the examinations in Harare. So I wrote to the chair, who was at that time Harold Shoaib, and asked, saying, you know, I would need these 10 days, could I have 10 days leave to go to the country? And he wrote back and said this was not part of what I was coming here for, and that I could not go. Well, I was rather surprised. I thought, well, what shall I do? I had it in mind perhaps to obliterate the whole thing, but I wasn't the only person involved. We had made arrangements for Patrick Bennett and his wife to have a flat in London. In fact, my son was living in it to get it ready for them. There were all kinds of arrangements which had been made. And it was by that point really pretty well impossible, without causing a great deal of distress, to cancel them. So I wrote to the University of Harare and told them about it, and they were extremely annoyed. They cancelled my contract, not just for that year, but for the remaining years. And they also cancelled that of David Rycroft, who was, of course, not best pleased. And I tried to explain to them and wrote, and but they still would not do, they wouldn't rescind it. And that, I'm afraid, was the price I had to pay for coming here. The cessation of my relationship with the University of Harare. And seeing that my major language is Shona, that was a deep dismay to me, as you can imagine.
An extremely high price to pay.
Yes. Now, and it was also partially due to my own ignorance of the way in which universities here are run. I had assumed that Harold Shoaib was head of department in the same sense as the head of department is in Britain. In Britain, if you are created head of department, that is a contract, if you like, until you either die or decide to give up. Or, as sometimes happens, your colleagues don't like the way you're doing it and ask for you to be kicked out. But otherwise, it is a sinecure. Mm-hmm. And I assumed that that was the case in this country also. I did not realise that the chair was chosen for for a three-year tenure. Mm-hmm. And then somebody else would be chosen. And in fact, that proved to be the case, of course. By the time I came over here, the chair had changed and was Neil Skinner, much to my surprise. And I talked this over with him, and he said he would have given me leave to go. He thought it was an important thing. Mm-hmm. But of course, by then it was too late to change anything.
So you are here,
yes.
1980 to 1981.
Yes.
I'd be interested if any of your recollections, observations about your experience, your first year teaching at the University of Wisconsin.
Yes, well, I principally taught my major language, Shona, excuse me, and this was to postgraduate students.
Oh.
I didn't have much to do with undergraduate students until I came back later on.
Uh-huh.
I think I gave a couple of lectures in one of the big courses. Perhaps it was the Introduction to African Studies or African Languages, something like that. 277, I think it is. Mm-hmm. You can find out about that. And the thing that struck me about the students there was that they were so young. Huh. Now, you do not go to university in Britain normally until you are at least 18.
Uh-huh.
And these seem to me to be more like school children. But as I say, I did not have much to do with them. My own students, and I didn't have very many, but they were postgraduate students, uh-huh. and they were very impressive.
Huh.
I found that they worked hard. They mostly had extracurricular jobs. They were supporting themselves through college, and I found that that was more often the case than not, that the students had outside jobs and were supporting themselves.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, they were managing to take on quite a load of academic work, so that did impress me. Now, when I got to grips with the organisation of courses, I found a good deal of difference, of course, from the way in which things are done here and in Britain. Firstly, the obsession with grades. Now, if you are a graduate student in Britain, you probably do go to courses, but on the whole, you don't have to take examinations. This is just part of your training. Whereas here, you have to maintain a grade, and the students were very keen to do that, and insisted that you keep giving them grades, which I hadn't been used to do at all.
No.
Nor had I been used to giving examinations so often. And eventually I said, well, I'm going to give you an examination at the end of, either at the end of the year or the end of the semester, and that will be your grade. And I had arguments about this. It wasn't fair to give you a grade on just that final examination. What about all the other? I said, I'll give you exercises during the semester. Of course I will, so that you can see what you need to do,
mm-hmm.
where your strengths are and where your weaknesses are. But I don't care how you start out. What I'm concerned about is how you end up.
Mm-hmm.
And that is your grade. Woo, dear. We had arguments about this.
Did you stand your ground?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I asked if I could, and they said, yes, you can. You can do that.
Mm-hmm.
But it was not. It was very un-American. And once or twice, I would talk to my colleagues about this sort of thing. And particularly when I was hearing about younger students, that's, the undergraduates,
mm-hmm.
Who weren't doing very well. And I would occasionally see papers, you see, that they'd written and so on, full of misspellings and so on. And I said, you know, this child is surely not university material. And my colleague would say something of the order of, oh, you British are elitist, aren't you? So, I tried to find out how they got into university.
Uh-huh.
There was no application examination, as I had told you.
Mm-hmm.
I had to sit 8 of them.
Right.
There was nothing like that, and there was no higher school certificate. And then I started finding out that the grades they got into university on were given by their school. There was not a national or even a state school leaving examination of, or the equivalent of our general school certificate or our higher school certificate, or as they are now, are the O-levels and the A-levels. Nothing like that. The school set the examinations, the school decided what grade you would get.
Mm-hmm.
And I was frankly horrified.
Hmm.
That there was no... And even when you took... Now this amazed me. If you were getting a PhD, Your committee consisted only of people from your own university. There was no external examiner. We had to have external examiners, as I've told you. Mm-hmm. I couldn't believe it. That there seemed to be no idea of a national standard.
Uh-huh.
Now, I believe this is something which has come up in discussions at a fairly high level.
Yes.
Since I was here then,
mm-hmm.
which is now, of course, over 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe there is beginning to be a movement to at least have a state examination, isn't there, for school leavers?
There are proposals for
yes.
tests.
Mm.
And they're statewide tests, and they're controversial.
Yes, I believe. Oh, no, so obviously they haven't gone. I believe they haven't gone through yet, and probably won't for some time if they ever do. But this is the kind of thing that I found to be one of the major differences in the higher school education in the two countries.
Mm-hmm.
As I say, I was impressed with the high level of some of the students.
Mm-hmm.
And this, of course, is bringing into play what I later found, rather than during that first year,
mm-hmm.
that undergraduates, to me, were still school children.
Mm-hmm.
A great many of them were not up to, in my view, to university level.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm an elitist, I suppose.
Well, let's just say you have perhaps higher standards. That doesn't necessarily mean elite.
But it's something that I think is extremely important. And now I have a grandson who lives here.
Oh.
So I'm even more interested in American education, obviously,
yes.
as it touches my grandson.
How old is he?
14.
Oh, so he's right in the thick of it.
Yes.
Is he going to the public schools?
No, he is going to a private school.
Mm-hmm.
He came over when he was about 11. He had been doing French at his school in Britain. Which was again a private school.
Mm-hmm.
And over here he had to start doing Spanish. However, his mother intervened, and I think his father too, and he is now allowed to do French again.
Hmm.
It's a pity in a way, because if he lives here, Spanish will probably be much more use to him.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope he will do both eventually.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that is still to come, but it certainly enhances my interest in American education.
I'm sure.
I should say, I think, something about the relationship between the African Languages and Literature Department here and SOAS in London, that's the School of Oriental and African Studies, in the Africa department there. And we have always had some kind of association right from the inception of the department here. I believe that Wilfred Whiteley, who was at one time our head of department and professor of Bantu languages, I believe that he did have something to do with founding the department, or at least was connected with it in some way. After him, Lyndon Harris came over here from SOAS and taught Swahili. Patrick Bennett came here. Of course, he had been on the staff, or that is to say the faculty, at SOAS, and also got his PhD there. After him, there was Magdalena Hauner. Magdalena had been a PhD student at SOAS. She had three supervisors there, Wilfred Whiteley, Malcolm Guthrie, and myself. And then she came over here to teach Swahili. She was here, I remember, when I came over in 1980-81. She had already come here. So we have already, we have had a number of people coming from SOAS here. They've also gone elsewhere. Irvin Richardson went to Michigan State University. Jack Berry went to Northwestern University. So that the brain drain, as it was called, was in full force. And I thought, well, maybe I should join it.
Did you sort of reach that conclusion during your year here? When, as the year was drawing to a close, did you think to yourself, I'd really like to come back here?
Yes, for a number of reasons. And one of them, of course, was that I was not very happy at SOAS. There had been a great deal of opposition to the things that I had tried to do. After considerable fights, I had managed to do some of them. But the atmosphere was not particularly congenial. Mm-hmm. And the people who had supported me were gone or had died. It seemed to me that, and also, of course, I did have this interest in the Creoles. Mm-hmm. And you have the Sea Island Creole here. And you're a lot nearer to the Caribbean.
Indeed.
So it seemed to me that I would have opportunity not simply to go on with my African studies, but also to pursue my interest in Creole studies and the participation of African languages mm-hmm. in the formation and the development of Creole languages here, and indeed General American. As I said, there are some words in General American that are from African languages.
Yes.
When I went back in 1981 to SOAS, the British universities were in deep trouble. They had, in my view, somewhat overexpanded after the war, building new universities, expanding the ones that existed, and according to the government anyway, setting up far too many departments of linguistics. Anyway, the government held one of its famous commissions and decided that the universities themselves had these meetings too, and decided that they would have to, term they use, downsize now? I don't think they used that term. They just talked about kicking people out. Well, having an early retirement system.
Mm-hmm.
The usual thing in a British university at that time was you would go on to 65. If your colleagues decided that you had undiminished vigour in teaching and research, then you were allowed another 2 years mm-hmm. to go on to 67. The voluntary retirement system that they set up said that you could retire if you were 65 or if you were 60 even. You had to promise or undertake that you would never take another job in a British university, and for that they would give you a certain amount of money, a nice sort of little package, a pension and so on. I wasn't anywhere near 60. However, that didn't get rid of enough people, so they put the age down to 55. Still no good for me. And still, not enough people went. This, incidentally, also applied to the teacher training colleges, not just the universities.
Huh.
I'm not surprised they had difficulties with the education system after that. But anyway, we are back in 1981, 82 and so on. Finally, they got down to 50. Hmm. And that then applied to me. I was in communication with people here, and particularly with Patrick, who by then, I think, had become chair. Yes. And he said, well, why not come over here? We can give you an honorary research fellowship or something of the sort, or a visiting professorship, something of that, and maybe you could get on to the faculty in the end, because we do need more people. We do need more to cover more languages. Mm-hmm. So I came over by myself. My children had by then left home. And by 1984, I had been promoted from honorary research fellow to visiting professor. They then put out advertisements for somebody new on the faculty. The university said they could not afford a full-time person. They understood the need for another person in the department, but it couldn't be a full-time person. It would have to be two-thirds. Mm-hmm. And, well, to cut a long story short, I got it. So I was at least a professor on the real faculty, if you like.
So you had two years here as a visiting professor.
Yes.
And you were basically teaching full-time as a visiting professor.
Well, no, I did. You're supposed to teach three courses a year, every semester, and I had two. But of course, I also had other things to do as well, supervising and all the rest of it. You know, it's just that I didn't take three courses a year.
I see.
Mm-hmm. My daughter got married in 1985. And in 1985, at the beginning of the year, just before the beginning of the year, the Leverhulme Research, the Leverhulme Foundation, I think it may have been called Research Foundation, I can't remember now, out of the blue offered me some money to do any research I wanted to do. Hmm. Amazing. They had heard that I had retired from SOAS, and I don't know how many people got these things, but I certainly got one. I had, as I've said, for some time been interested in Creole languages as they were affected by or influenced by African languages. And I had got to know about the Kumina people in Jamaica, who are one of the religious sects who base their religion on an African religion, and also use a sort of pidginized form of Congo as their religious language and to some extent in their daily life. And I had been very interested in this. It had been written about to some extent. So I wanted to go out to Jamaica and study this. I wrote to the university at Mona in Jamaica, and they were delighted and said, oh yeah, come over here. We can give you a university flat and we can arrange things for you and even give you a bit of money.
Sounds good to
me. Amazing, especially as I hadn't asked for any. Well, I had written to Mona and asked if I could come over. But it was a wonderful thing to happen. So I went over there for the 3 months and worked on Kumina. Mm-hmm. And eventually published on it. And then came back again. I was still as a visiting professor. And later that year, I was divorced. I divorced my husband after my daughter's wedding. Mm-hmm. Can we sort of leave it at that for the moment?
This concludes side one of tape four. This is side two of tape four, Professor Emerita Hazel Carter, African Languages and Literature, July 6th, 2006. So it's in 1986 then that you're offered a two-thirds position.
Well, I think here. In fact it was in 1985 that I was offered the position, but when the question came of getting my resident alien status, because I was just on a visa, you see.
Yes.
I think they call it a J-1. if you're visiting, you're allowed this temporary residence permit. But if for a permanent one, and the immigration and naturalization people said that they would not issue a permanent residence permit for someone who was just on a part-time appointment. Hmm. Now, I had the developments in my personal life had led to the fact that I was engaged to marry Professor Frederick Cassidy. And in fact, in 1986, we did marry. And eventually, I managed to get a residence permit on the grounds of being married to him. He was by then an American citizen. Mm-hmm. So I did get a residence permit.
Not based on your marital status and not on your scholarship or your position here.
Yes. Uh-huh. Because it was not a full-time position. Well, I was a full professor, but not a full-time professor.
And two-thirds wasn't enough.
No.
It had to be full-time or nothing. So then you...
It's a narrow squeak.
Yes, I'll say. So you appear on campus the fall of 1986 as a full professor, but on a two-thirds appointment.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And you must have come with tenure?
Yes. Mm-hmm. It was appointed with merit for some reason. I was coming on for 60 then, wasn't I? So I remember one of the committee who were, you know, monitoring my application at the university. Baldis Seps, did you ever meet Baldis Seps?
No.
He was one of them. He met me in the lift, at the elevator one day, with a whole box of stuff, and apparently he had been told off to read all my articles. It's nothing to do with, well, not directly to do with what he did. He was a linguist, of course, but he looked at me with a great deal of, I'm not quite sure how to put it, not scorn. He was obviously a bit peeved at having to read all this stuff. He said, "Published a lot, haven't you?" So I said, "I'm sorry." Anyway.
Life in academe.
Yes.
It's hardly what the uninitiated think it is.
No, all this ivory tower stuff.
Simply not true, is
Absolutely
it?
Absolutely not, no. No. So then I started having rather different sorts of students and so on. And doing a good many more things than I had been doing.
Can you talk a little bit about some of the courses you developed here?
Yes, those were the ones at London, all right.
Because there are a number that you started here.
Yes.
And And we're interested in your teaching experience here. You've already started commenting on the students, but this is where you're encountering far more undergraduates, I suspect.
To some extent, and I think that anything over 300 and over is a graduate, isn't it, or is it the 500?
It's the 500.
Ah, yes, because 202 and 315, that's the first and second semesters of Congo, mm-hmm. For undergraduates, and all of the ones in Shona, mm-hmm. are for undergraduates. Everything else above that, the 500s and the 600s and the 900s and so on, are graduate, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
I'm accustomed to talking about postgraduates, where I think you simply call them graduates.
Yes.
I've got to the point now where I sometimes don't know which is British and which is American. I mean, I don't know whether my car has a hood or a bonnet and that sort of thing, you know?
Well, you move easily in two worlds, we should say.
I don't know, I think I'm falling through the cracks. Anyway, however, this does bring up something that we mentioned before. That is the fact that I had students, not simply Americans, but in those days particularly, quite a number of African students from African countries,
uh-huh.
some of whom were from places like Nigeria and Ghana and so on, which had been British colonies. And they understood me quite often better than the Americans did,
uh-huh.
not simply for the accent, but sometimes for the vocabulary. I remember talking at one point about, I had gone on secondment to somewhere. And the Americans said, huh, you know. Ghanaian student said, I know what that is. He was so pleased at knowing something they didn't. But that quite often happened, that I would use a term or use a pronunciation that the African students would understand,
mm-hmm.
and the American students didn't.
We were talking earlier, and it's just a different perspective. Americans, I think, find the British accent charming, cute, amusing.
Sometimes they say it's quaint.
Quaint, yes. and I think we forget that, in fact, British English probably has a far, at least up to a point, had a far wider following.
At one time, I think, yes. Mm-hmm. I think you couldn't say that. Now, because, of course, once it becomes separated from the mother country or whatever you choose to call it, it tends to develop on its own, you see. I mean, South African English, Australian English, not to speak of American English, but that's a different question, I think. But they are developing away from British English. Now, of course, it is said that American English still retains 17th century features in its pronunciation particularly,
mm-hmm.
that we have changed in Britain.
I have heard that, but I don't know what the evidence for that is.
Some of it, I think, is in poetry, the rhymes that are used. And I can't think of a good example at the moment. But things, words that no longer rhyme in British English,
oh.
apparently do in American English. And I don't know enough about that.
Uh-huh.
But you might ask somebody in the English department, they would probably know. Yes, the courses I taught here. To begin with, it was principally, of course, my languages, or just two of them anyway, Shona, and also to some extent Congo. Shona was, as you might say, my bread and butter language, and I taught that more, mm-hmm. Than any other. Interestingly, I may have said something about the fact that Shona is a tone language.
Yes, you did.
Yes. And I know that it is taught, that Shona is taught in various other places, Florida, Michigan State University. I'm not sure about Urbana-Champaign, but it certainly has been taught in various places. Now, I have always insisted that my students learn the tonal system, otherwise they are not learning the language. And in fact, I think the man who bosses up the Florida course refuses to use my materials because I insist on having the tone in. He says students can't do that. I hope I have proved him wrong. Students uh-huh. here certainly did manage to do it.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, one of my students, when she went out to Zimbabwe, they were absolutely astonished at the fact that here she was, a white girl and an American, able to speak Shona with the tone system mm-hmm. in place. So that was an interesting to see that it could be done here. Teaching undergraduates was, which I occasionally had to do, was very much more difficult for reasons that I've already gone into, really. They didn't mm-hmm. seem to have the background in anything that I had assumed. And they didn't seem to like it when I said, well, now go through this during the long vacation,
mm-hmm.
which they had always done at Oxford. I always had to do quite a hefty lot of work during the summer vacation. Here students don't seem to do that very much. Oh, you know, maybe it was just the individuals I had.
No, it's the system.
Mm-hmm. One thing that did please me was that I was able eventually to introduce, as you see, there's a course here called African Languages and the New World,
mm-hmm.
which was the way in which African languages have influenced and participated in the development of languages here, because we did have some students from the Caribbean.
Mm-hmm.
We had some from Africa who were delighted that their languages had something to do with it. Then there's African Languages and Caribbean Creoles. Now that was a 900 one. I think that is a one that is a directed study, isn't it? I seem to remember that. Directed study or something for a dissertation.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't just a regular course that you have an examination for and so on. That's my somewhat hazy memory anyway. But I was delighted to be able to do university courses in that.
Mm-hmm.
I had complaints from some of the students that I made them read too much. And again, this I wonder if this is something to do with the methods used in teaching in schools here, about which I know very little.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't seem to me that they are taught very much to do work on their own.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is certainly coming into the university more than it was.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the African Languages in the New World, African Languages and Caribbean Creoles were two that gave me very great pleasure uh-huh. in order to develop and to teach.
And you were able to develop them pretty much how you wanted.
Yes, yeah. Oh yes. There were other people, especially in the Afro-American department, who were interested in these things too. I think, get one of my courses cross-listed for a time.
Oh, you did?
Mm. With that department. Rich Ralston was a good friend in that respect. Now, although I had not got it asterisked, the phonology and tonology of African languages, which was one of the beginning courses for graduate students, was another one that particularly delighted me, because it was one of my major disciplinary topics, if you like,
uh-huh.
You know, phonology and particularly tonology of African languages, and I enjoyed that enormously.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is one thing about working here. I have enjoyed it. Now, there have been difficulties, yes, and there have been, I've indicated things that I didn't like, or that I fought against to some extent, or tried to get changed, but by and large, I have enjoyed teaching here.
Mm-hmm. And what has been enjoyable as you compare this experience to SOAS?
The fact that things that I suggested and wanted to do seemed acceptable. Whereas in London, I very often had to fight a lot
mm-hmm.
to get new courses in
mm-hmm.
and to get them accepted by the college. Once you got past the college, the university was on the whole pretty acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
But here, of course, you don't have the college and the university.
Right.
You have the university, mm-hmm. and the department is part of the university rather than of a college.
Correct.
However, one thing I did miss, and I think I mentioned this earlier on, I'm not sure if we got it on the tape, the lack of a senior common room.
Yes, you were going to talk about that. You said you even brought it up to Phil Certain when
yes,
he was dean.
That's right. The senior common room is a place where, if it's a senior common room, where the faculty will go, drink coffee, sit and talk in between their teaching. It's a place, a recreation room, if you like. I mean, you don't go there and play games or anything. You just go and talk to people. And I found that, in London particularly, a very fruitful source of ideas. You would talk to somebody in another department and find that there was some topic that you had in common and on which both of you could give a different perspective, suggest books to read, even perhaps try and develop a course together. And as I said, I found that very fruitful. Here, I didn't see my colleagues in that way.
Hmm.
They were in their own offices or they were home.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked to Phil Certain about it, and of course he had worked in British universities too, I can't remember which ones, and he said, yes, I miss the common room too. Of course, you also, in a British university or in a British college, also have a junior common room for the graduates and undergraduates, for the students.
Hmm.
I remember going back to my college in Oxford, which was, when I was there, a women's college, going into the JCR, the junior common room, and being astonished to find men there. Because by then it had become a co-ed college. It was a women's college when I went there. Anyway, the point is that you had the same kind of interaction among the students as you would get in the senior common room, or the same, you know, on a different level perhaps, but you did meet students from other disciplines.
Does the university club not meet that function here?
No, I hardly ever went there. I didn't even know about it.
Oh.
And in any case, I was in Van Nuys. Mm-hmm. The university club's way down there.
Right.
The nearest thing we had was a place where you could go and get stuff out of machines. You go get coffee and tea. Oh, we couldn't get tea, no. I remember meeting Dan there once and saying, oh, I wish I had a cup of tea. He said, oh, the English woman wants her cup of tea.
So when you talk about a senior commons room, you would be proposing a space in Van Hise, for instance.
Yes.
Where the various faculty in that building, at least, would gather.
Yes, yes. And as I said, I talked to Phil Certain about it. He said, I do wish we had the room to have that. He could see the value of it. Mm-hmm. And perhaps when they tear Van Hise down and rebuild it, maybe they'll have something. But, you know, there was hardly enough room for people to have offices. They had to share offices and so on. There certainly wasn't room for a common room.
And let me ask you, just to speculate a little bit, we were talking at the beginning of this interview about computers and problems with computers. I just wonder what your feeling is as more and more faculty work longer hours at home with their computers and communicate with computers. If even if the new Van Hise had a common room, do you think people would use it?
They'd still need to drink coffee during the day, wouldn't they? They would need to sit somewhere.
So if the space were provided, you think it would be utilized and that people, faculty, remain interested in intellectual exchange with their colleagues?
Well, I am no prophet. I don't know. I would hope so. I would think so. I would think that anybody who came from a background with common rooms mm-hmm. would naturally gravitate there. Mm-hmm. But I couldn't really be sure, obviously.
Okay. Well, I won't make you promise what it will be like in the future. I was just...
Yeah. The computer, of course, may have changed things a lot, because when we had computers introduced, I was in my office till 11 o'clock at night, most nights, you know, producing materials. So now you have if you have a computer at home, perhaps you would go home and do it. But then... No, if you look at something like London University, most people lived... You had to live within 30 miles of London.
Oh, you did?
You were supposed to. I didn't. you were... in fact, most people didn't live near the university, whereas they do here. Mm-hmm. So you do have opportunities for seeing your colleagues outside the university, even though you're not... even though you're at home, if you you can have people see you at home, whereas in London, the common room is virtually the only place you would see your colleagues.
Uh-huh.
That may have a bearing on it, but then thinking of Oxford, there was a senior common room in every college there. You would see your colleagues there.
Uh-huh.
And some people did actually live in the vicinity. They would still come to the common room.
Uh-huh.
But
you really, you noticed that as a glaring loss.
Yes, yes, uh-huh. I did, yes. Uh-huh. And as I say, Phil and I did talk about it from time to time.
Let me ask you, as you look at your courses, who were the students coming? You know, were there a lot of white students, and why were they taking African languages?
Very often, the white students who came, and this is true of the department as a whole, had been in Peace Corps. Some of them had been in Africa in the Peace Corps and had got interested in things African from that perspective. And some of them wanted to go back.
Uh-huh.
I would say, perhaps the principal incentive for uh-huh. most of the white students who came.
Did you have a sense that there were some students who were interested in diplomatic or foreign service?
Yes. In fact, one of them went out there and was offered a job in the service. Yeah, because she was so good at, this was a girl who was good at Shona. In the end, I think for personal reasons she declined, but she could have had that. And I couldn't give you any statistics. You'd need to look at the departmental records to see who did what. Certainly one or two of mine went into what I'd call the civil service. Diplomatic corps, yes. I would recommend you to see if there are departmental records of that. Mostly, of course, we didn't talk about what they were going to do. I had a number of African students, of course, and they were mostly, in fact, most of them were at PhD level. Some of them had jobs waiting for them in Africa. Quite a lot of them were dying to stay here.
Really?
Yes. Yes, some of them have.
Did you have many Afro-American kids?
Oh, yes. Now, I personally did not. There were a good many in the department. And a lot of them were searching for their roots, of course. I think now we have Yoruba. That has been a great success. Yoruba is one of the languages that was certainly involved in slavery. It's one of the major ones that Lorenzo Dow Turner used in his work on Gullah. And he traced a lot of things back to Yoruba that I think probably came from Congo. But no, the point is that Yoruba has been a very important language, and you may be aware, now I have to be very careful about this. One of our students became a priestess in one of the Yoruba-derived religious sects. Now, people think, or people like to think, that this is a survival from the time of slavery. To some extent it may be, but mostly it is a revival starting in the 19th century. And people have come over from Nigeria, priests and priestesses and so forth, to organize things. It is more of a revival than a survival. And I offended one of my students very much by saying this, because she wanted to believe that it was survival from the times of slavery. Anyway, that has been one of the reasons why Yoruba has been such a success. We also, of course, have a Yoruba to teach it. Yeah, Antonia Schleicher, you know?
The name.
Yes. She is Yoruba. And so she has the connections, and people can go back to Nigeria and so on, and she can do so many more things than a white person could, of course. And she has made a great success of the Yoruba.
This concludes side two of tape four.